Good afternoon. This program is Live and Local. It's your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. And coming up, I'll be talking with Professor Sever Tepe of the University of Illinois School of Music. He is manager of the computer music project of the U of I Experimental Music Studios, the computer music project celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And they'll be giving a couple of concerts to enhance that celebration, including later on this week, on March 5th at 7:30. And we'll be hearing more about that from Professor Tepe. But first, on Saturday, the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra will perform a concert that it calls Inextinguishable, which takes its name from the main work, the largest work on that program, which will occupy the second half by Carl Nielsen, his Symphony No. 4, which is known as the Inextinguishable. I'll be talking with music director Stephen Altop in just a moment. Here's how that symphony begins. And that is a bit of the very beginning of the Fourth Symphony by Danish composer Carl Nielsen. It has the nickname of the Inextinguishable, and we'll certainly find out why coming up. The piece will close the concert Saturday night by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, which will be conducted by Stephen Altop, its music director, still in his first season in that capacity, and a nicely varied and quite interesting-looking program that will complete that. As I said, that begins the final part of the concert. We'll come back to that piece in a little bit. My guest this portion of Live and Local is Stephen Altop. Thanks for coming in again.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. And this is what, concert 3 or 4?
Well, this will be my fourth concert to conduct this season, including our holiday concert and the third of our subscription programs.
Is it fair to say you're breaking the orchestra into you, or you to them, or I guess both?
Well, I would say both are fair in that we're getting to know each other. And our last concert, which included Beethoven, was a great opportunity to just, I think, build the sound and the ensemble of the orchestra. This present program is an extremely challenging one. It is full of orchestral virtuosity.
And was that the intention that it be a particularly virtuosic program, or circumstantial to the program you happen to choose?
Well, it is circumstantial to this program. I am very fond of this collection of pieces. This is not the first time that I have put these pieces together on a program. This combination, which begins with a piece for strings called Signs of Life by Russell Peck, moves on then to The Lark Ascending, a very poetic work for solo violin, which will be played by our concertmaster, Igor Kalnin, and this is by Ray Von Williams, one of the most poetic pieces for solo violin and orchestra, followed by The Prelude and Transfiguration, sometimes called Liebestod, from the opera by Richard Wagner, Tristan and Isolde, one of the most passionate pieces of music. And those three works, combined with the final work on the program, the Inextinguishable Symphony No. 4 of Carl Nielsen, to me suggest the ability of music to convey the indomitability of human life and spirit and love.
That makes it sound not only passionate but very full.
It is a very full experience, I would say that. To just take the symphony by itself by Carl Nielsen is a rather intense listening experience. And I certainly will share some words from the stage with the audience before they hear it, because I want them to listen for certain things. This is a piece that goes straight through. It's not in a traditional four movements that are interrupted by pauses. Nielsen goes from one section of the piece to the next, and the music that you opened today's discussion with is the very beginning of the symphony, full of just almost violent torment and upheaval. This piece comes from the beginning of World War I, and there was a great deal of upheaval in Europe at that time, and one could almost assign sort of an idea of political discourse and upheaval going on in the beginning of this symphony.
What does the name come from, the Inextinguisher? Is that something he gave to it?
It is, because Nielsen inscribed at the beginning of the score a little statement that ends with, "Music is life, and like it, inextinguishable." And this piece very much is a reflection of life, I believe, because the second section of the work seems to me to suggest very clearly the beauty and warmth and comfort of home life and the love of family. It's very sweet and almost folk-like, and one can imagine the peacefulness of a village far removed from this political turmoil that the beginning of the work so clearly suggests.
Some of the second portion, I don't quite want to say second movement, of the Symphony No. 4 by Carl Nielsen, which is described here in the press release to this particular concert, which will be by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra Saturday night, as moving through several scenes of life, which is a little different from how you just put it, which made me think of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, which he describes as very much, you know,
That's a good analogy. That's a good analogy. Of course, the Beethoven is in five movements, and the Nielsen Symphony No. 4 is in four sections. But just as Beethoven has this pastoral second movement, the scene by the brook, this second section of the Nielsen Symphony is very sweet and folk-like, and conveyed mostly by the wind instruments, which have quite a soothing sound. And there's even a section later where the solo bassoon takes a very grandfatherly sort of lead, it would seem, almost like a grandfather surrounded by small children. But that is interrupted by a very intense statement high on the violins of a line that reminds me of almost a sloganistic song of going to war, like the sort of heroic, optimist viewpoint that young soldiers might have. And that is punctuated by rather menacing sounds on the timpani and low strings. And the beauty of the home life is definitely being threatened by the time we get to the third section.
And that, so the portion we were just listening to, these are not marked as movements at all?
Just tempo changes, that's all.
Tempo changes and sort of implications. So the beginning of this third section of The Inextinguishable Symphony of Carl Nielsen. Brief tour continues of Carl Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, nicknamed The Inextinguishable. His name to it, so often names of symphonies like that don't come from the composer themselves. This piece will be performed by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, conducted by Stephen Althoff Saturday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And Stephen, what is the next scene of life, let's say?
Well, we were just listening to that beginning of the third section of the symphony, where that one very spirited line in the violin is then taken up by other lines of the orchestra all over this sort of menacing punctuation of the timpani and the low strings. And we were just coming into the contrasting place where solo strings play incredibly warm music that could almost be the scene of mothers saying farewell to sons going off to war. The final section begins very abruptly and with incredible energy. It is the unleashing of the symphony orchestra with about as much energy as it possesses, starting with the strings. And basically a battle ensues. Nielsen calls for two sets of timpani placed on opposite sides of the stage, and those two sets of drums basically thunder at each other, very much as would happen in a battle. And it's incredibly intense until finally the music seems to well up and everything that's been battling comes together in a great major keyed triumphant scene. Thank you.
So that is the beginning portion of what we could call, for lack of a, in a conventional way, the final movement, the final section of the Fourth Symphony of Carl Nielsen. And then the progress to the end, it brightens up a bit.
It does. After all this turmoil, sort of like after an intense thunderstorm, when the final triumphant sounds come from the orchestra and the timpanis sort of unite together, it's really exciting. I think it's one of the most exciting endings in symphonic music.
Well, so I guess we sort of gave away the conclusion of Saturday Night's Concert by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, but we left out so much in between.
That's right. It's a good overview, though.
Of really intriguing, and as you say, it sounds like quite an exciting piece and dramatic piece and passionate and all kinds of other emotional superlatives.
Yes, I think it's music that people can relate to, although not all of us are Scandinavian. We've been living in a rather Scandinavian climate of late. So maybe our sensibilities will be heightened to receive this music. Nielsen's subsequent symphonies get sort of more and more idiosyncratic. And I once had a colleague say to me that basically you almost need to be Scandinavian to understand his next symphony, and you must be to understand his last symphony. So probably living in a rather bleak world in the winter would help you get this. But this particular symphony, the fourth, I think can speak to all people, especially if they have an idea what to listen for.
Stephen Altop will conduct that concert Saturday night. It starts at 7:30 at the Krannert Center, and it opens with music, as he referenced earlier, by a fellow named Scott Peck is another conductor I know.
Yes, he is.
Russell Peck, the late Russell Peck now, died a few years ago, I think. A piece called Signs of Life 2.
Well, Signs of Life 2 is a three-movement version of his original Signs of Life. We're actually doing his original Signs of Life, which is just the two movements, the arioso and then final movement.
And who's Russell Peck, or was Russell?
Russell Peck is an American composer, and he wrote a lot of very descriptive music, and music that one of his better-known pieces is his percussion concerto, which is very exciting for three soloists. And of his pieces, and I've conducted several, this is the one I'm most fond of, because I think it shows off the string orchestra to really good effect. And it's all about sort of the percolation of life. At the beginning of the last movement or second movement, you clearly hear this sort of pulsation that develops into something more, and soon the whole string orchestra is playing in very lively, jazzy rhythms.
Sounds like one of those pieces that sort of builds inevitably from little fragments, and jazzy ones at that, as you said. The Scherzo, or the second section of the Signs of Life for String Orchestra by American composer Russell Peck, played here by the Alabama Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Paul Polivnik. And it occurs to me, I didn't credit the performers of the Nielsen Symphony, which we were sampling earlier, which is the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Apologies to Sir Colin for not giving him full credit there. Stephen Alltop will conduct this whole concert, of course, Saturday night by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, which continues with The Lark Ascending, which is one of the probably better-known pieces by Ray Vaughan Williams, and so typical of his, the term always gets used, pastoral, the pastoral side of his being.
I would agree. It certainly conveys the idea of nature, and to my mind, this piece is a beautiful contrast to the works around it. And usually when we have violin soloists, we expect technical fireworks, but this piece is all about lyricism and really, I think, the spirit soaring in the image of the lark.
Thank you.
sort of hard to break away from such a gorgeous piece. It's The Lark Ascending by Ray Vaughan Williams. Hugh Bean playing the solo violin part with the New Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. Igor Kalinin will take the violin solo with the CU Symphony, Champaign-Urbana Symphony, Saturday night, with led by Stephen Alltop. And one other piece in the program we've just mentioned by, and is probably the very best known,
yes,
by Richard Wagner.
The work that is often called Prelude and Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde. Tristan and Isolde is quite a remarkable piece because Wagner did some very revolutionary things with his treatment of harmony. He wanted to convey the idea of this unquenchable, unrequited, or unsatisfied love between Tristan and Isolde, Tristan being under a spell, of course. And to do that, he modified his use of harmony from what had been conventional to make chords that never really seemed to resolve. And so one is left with this constant feeling of yearning and moving forward. And from the very beginning of the work, which is set for the solo cellos, you have that feeling. Now, the actual last movement, which often is called Liebestod, Wagner called Verklärung, or Transfiguration, Isolde's Verklärung. And it was actually Franz Liszt, when he made a transcription for piano, that took this German word that he invented, Liebestod, or love death. And that seemed to sort of stick. But I use the original title of Wagner. And so this pairing of the very beginning of the opera and then the very end, leaving out about 4.5 hours of music in between, is a very satisfying combination.
It's the very end of the opera, Tristan and Isolde by Richard Wagner, and the end of the portion known as the Transfiguration, as it's paired with the Prelude, which, of course, is the very beginning of the opera. The Chicago Symphony here played, conducted by Sir George Schulte, and Stephen Alltop will conduct the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra in a performance of both sections Saturday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana, a concert that starts at 7:30 and has music by Russell Peck, Ray Fawn Williams, Carl Nielsen, and features the concertmaster of the orchestra, Igor Kalnin. And I think you said, Stephen, you're ending the first half with that music.
Yes, yeah. We are.
It would be hard to follow it with something.
Well, an intermission else is a good way, yeah, before the Nielsen.
Well, I appreciate your coming in and letting us know about the program, giving us such a finely articulated tour of the music and why you chose it.
Oh, thanks very much. I really dearly love this music, and I'm very much looking forward to performing it in the sonic splendor of the Krannert Center.
For more information and to get tickets, you can go to krannertcenter.com, and of course, there's always the box office on concert night. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
Live and Local today is supported in part by the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-333-4577. Next up on our program today, my guest is Sever Tipe, who is professor of music at the University of Illinois School of Music here in Urbana-Champaign. He is also, for the purposes of the conversation, manager of the Computer Music Project, which is part of the Experimental Music Studios at the U of I. And the Computer Music Project this year celebrates its 30th anniversary. Do the math. They were founded then in 1984. And I guess I'll let Dr. Tipe say why.
Why? Because a group of us were interested in working with computers in producing music, and there was no equipment available at the time, or very scarce equipment for such a purpose. So we kind of banded together and wrote a grant proposal to the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts. They had a program called Centers for New Music, and they gave us $9,000, and the research board gave us a much more generous amount. School of Music contributed a little bit, and that allowed us and our students to produce computer music, which, as probably you know, started here at University of Illinois.
I did know that, and there's a plaque outside the music building saying so.
That's right, 1956.
What was the appeal for you and your colleagues of using computers in music?
Well, our entire team, so to speak, in the School of Music of composers, it's kind of bent on the idea of experimenting, of experimental music. That's why the name of the studio, Experimental Music Studios. And we were trying to use technology to produce music at the time. As I said before, this idea grew from the experiments of Lejar and Hiller in 1956, who was the first person to compose a piece of music using digital computers.
What were at the time some of the other experimental ways of producing music not involving computers?
Not involving computers. This was at the end of almost two decades in which a lot of composers were experimenting with improvisation and also in instrumental and vocal music with what it's called extended techniques, different ways of producing sounds than the ones that traditionally we teach our students in classes.
So, for example, I remember actually in a choral conducting course of all places having a demonstration. I think one of your colleagues, Eric Lund, brought mm-hmm. his trombone in and was demonstrating what you call extended techniques on the trombone, where you could actually, I don't remember exactly what he did, but I suppose you could turn the mouthpiece the other way around and produce a different kind of sound. And
sure.
you could take the slide out of the end of the trombone, and that would produce a different kind of sound.
Right.
Again, I don't remember exactly what he did, but those are examples of that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. And also, they are not only limited to instrumental music and vocal music. There have been a lot of experiments like this. William Brooks, who used to teach here, and now it's at York University in England, had an ensemble, a choral ensemble that was playing things like Stockhausen Stimmung, which is a piece based on the usage of formants, of vowel formants, and they sing one chord for about an hour, just changing the vowels, and it's a very interesting piece.
Interesting piece. How many people will sit through it?
I would. I think it's one of the most beautiful things that he played, he composed. Yeah.
So talk about the notion of computer music. And I mean, I'm looking at the program, and I failed to say so far that there are two concerts that will help to celebrate this 30th anniversary of the Computer Music Project at the University of Illinois, the first of which is tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Music Building Auditorium, and then the second will be about a month from now on Tuesday, April the 8th, also at the same place at the same time. And I'm looking at the program for tomorrow night's concert, and there are composers' names attached. And one of the questions I wonder about is, if you're using computers to produce music, where does the composer fit in?
Well, the composer remains the composer. First of all, most of these pieces are using sound synthesis made out with the computer. In other words, the computer, it's an instrument, but the composer still composes the music in more or less traditional ways. Some of these compositions, though, are computer-assisted or algorithmic composition, where the logic of the composition, it's handled by the computer.
Let's explore that coming up. But since you mentioned that Lejarin Hiller wrote the very first piece generated by computer, called his Iliac Suite, actually for string quartet. So the string quartet plays.
The string quartet plays. Hiller was a chemist, and he was teaching chemistry here at the University of Illinois. At the same time, or before that, he had studied composition, among others, with Milton Babbitt at Princeton. And he continued his studies of composition here until he got a degree, a master's degree in composition. So this is actually his master's thesis. He experimented with the possibility of the digital computer to be fed rules of composition. And those rules are pretty simple, pretty obvious. They are the rules of species counterpoint that any sophomore student probably has to go through in our program. So he fed these rules and also added another element, which is the randomness. So the computer will randomly pick up a sound and then we'll check if it breaks any of the rules. If we would break a rule, then the experiment will be ended as a non-successful one. If it didn't, it will continue until it will break the rule again.
And eventually you have a piece of music.
Eventually you have a piece of music. So the movements of the quartet are even called Experiment 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And here is a part of Experiment 1. It actually has a conventional tempo markings, presto, andante, and allegro, so fast, slow-ish, really fast, slow-ish, and fast. And it will be played on the concert tomorrow night by four students at the University of Illinois, Yong Kwon Go, Sewon Oh, Lydia Tang, and Myo Ah Seo. And who's playing it on this recording? I guess I have that in front of me.
It's an old recording with also people from U of I.
From back in 1967.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
This is some of the Iliac Suite, Quartet No. 4 for strings by Lejarin Hiller and Leonard Isaacson here on Live and Local. Thank you. That is actually most of the first movement, Experiment 1, from the Quartet No. 4 for Strings, known as the Iliac Suite, by Lejarin Hiller and Leonard Isaacson, played back in 1967 by a string quartet simply known as the Composition String Quartet at the University of Illinois. And that music, the very first composed with computer.
That's right.
Exclusively with computer.
Exclusively with computer. Hiller was a scientist, and he would take whatever the computer would give him. He was never going to add things or correct things that he didn't like, which is the same aesthetics that Herbert Brunn followed in his music and his works.
And Herbert Brunn also was on the University of Faculty
was
for a long time.
For a long time.
And there's a composition of his on tomorrow's program called A Mere Ripple, as well as music by a fellow I remember meeting, Donica Dennehy. This is called Gooboo, which, where does that title come from?
Well, it's an acronym. It comes from, let me see. It's a phrase, grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre, and unprecedented.
And
which in his program notes, he says that this was coined by a prime minister of Ireland in the context of some fights that they had in their assembly there.
And that's where Donica happens to be from. We're going to let folks sample some of that on their own when they go to the concert. Some of it works a little bit better than others on radio. But I wanted to ask before we move on to a very different sort of computer music. You were telling me a bit as we were listening to that first movement of the Iliac Suite that in each of the subsequent three experiments, he feeds different kinds of rules to the computer.
Yes.
And the resulting music is quite different as a result.
Yes. In the first movement, as you heard, it starts with creating a melody, sort of a cantus firmus, as we call it in counterpoint. Then he goes into some combination of species counterpoint, two notes, one note against another, two notes against one, and so on. The second movement starts in a more or less chaotic stage, but then focuses more and more on such counterpoint rules. The third movement deals with various way of playing the instruments and rhythmic problems. And the fourth movement uses stochastic distributions in order to create the music.
What are some of the ways in which computer-generated music has evolved over those 30 years?
Well, most of the computer music nowadays, it's done more or less by hand and concentrates on the sound synthesis process. But a number of mathematical tools have been adopted. More prominent, it's Yannick Xenakis, the composer, who shortly after Hiller in the early 60s used a program to generate his music mostly with stochastic distributions. Also, Markov chains, another mathematical tool, has been used extensively by many composers, including Heinrich Taube on the faculty of University of Illinois. And I can continue. The list, it's pretty long.
But when the piece we heard was real people playing real instruments,
right,
and I'm using these terms not to be pejorative, of music that was written essentially by the computer. The music we're going to hear next was actually the sounds are computer sounds.
Yes, and not all pieces on the program, but some are exactly as you say. They were composed by a human with no aid from the computer, and then the computer produced the sounds.
In the case of this piece, it's one of the shorter ones on the concert. It's by a fellow named Kurt Werner, with the they all have curious titles, I would have to say. This one is Klang with a bunch of N's, 3,000, I'm reading Roman numerals here, 3,270.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the notes, and there's absolutely no explanation for that title whatsoever.
Yeah, I guess you make whatever you want out of it.
Is this one of those that is generated how?
This is generated. It's a class project, believe it or not. It's a very good piece, I think, but it was generated in class with a synthesis program that is pretty sophisticated, but it was driven, as they call it in computer science, by a relatively simple program that organized the attributes of one sound at a time. So the composer composed one sound at a time, but then he put them together in a subjective way, according to his will.
Here's music by Kurt Werner, which will be heard on tomorrow night's concert celebrating the 30th anniversary of the University of Illinois Computer Music Project. This is Live and Local. So that's actually the complete work, Klang 3270 by Kurt Werner, and performed by Kurt Werner, I guess.
That's right.
part of the Computer Music Project 30th anniversary concert that will happen tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Music Building Auditorium. And the second of those concerts will be on Tuesday, April the 8th. The Computer Music Project is directed by Sever Tepe, who is a professor of music at the University of Illinois School of Music, and they're all part of the Experimental Music Studios. And are you involved yourself, I assume, in the
yes.
ongoing composition?
Yes, I am. It's just this time I thought that would be nice to look at more historical works, and also a few of our students, present students.
What are some of the techniques that you use?
I do have a software that was developed here and also at the Argonne National Laboratory outside Chicago. And it's a software that unifies the process of composition and sound synthesis. And that's basically what I'm using.
And we have like 3 minutes, and I can't even, it's difficult to ask any further questions, really, because there's a lot of questions that I would have if we had a whole hour to talk about computer music, which is, well, I think we'll have to leave it at that and let people go to the concert if they like. It's a free program?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I assume. And then on the one on April 8th, there will be, earlier in that afternoon, at 3 in the afternoon, there will be a composer's forum going on, so a lot of discussion.
Yes, sort of a round table.
A round table about some of the history of the project and where computer music is going.
Right.
It started here at the University
of
Illinois.
Started here, yes.
In a moment, we'll hear just a little bit of some of the final piece on that program. Let me mention that our broadcast today is made possible with support from the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to the newest music theater work from Meredith Monk, On Behalf of Nature, on Thursday, March 6th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com. This is 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR and classical music and more for Central Illinois. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Thanks very much for coming in and letting us know about the concert and this tiniest thumbnail sketch of some of what can happen.
Well, thank you for inviting me and promoting the concert.
Here is very beginning of a piece by Sean Harold, who will also have music played by the University of Illinois Chamber Orchestra Thursday night at the Krannert Center. His piece, The Sky is Cold, First Iteration, will be on the Computer Music Project concert tomorrow night at 7:30.